Good evening. Pretty juicy night, isn't it? Amazing. Very nice to see you all. I got a very nice thing from Russ in the mail. That's a follow-up on what I talked about last week. And it's so nice, I thought I would share it with you all. I talked about the session that I went to in Taos for a week. It turned out that the man who was the director of Hokoji for many years was not just sick, as we thought, with quite a long time still to go. He suddenly got very sick after I got there and proceeded to get sicker and sicker. So suddenly the whole subject of the session became death and dying and life. We had tea every afternoon with a discussion, and I left it open for people to bring up whatever subject they interested them, and it was invariably something about what we were actually experiencing. And Arthur was in the very next room in bed, so deaf he couldn't hear what we were saying, but he knew we were there. And so it was extremely touching and very intense. So I didn't even know this book existed. I'm really glad to know about it. It's called The Second Book of the Tao. I know he translated, Stephen Mitchell translated the Tao Te Ching, but the second book of the Tao, I don't know. So, but he said pretty much what we said last week. Life is the companion of death. Death is the beginning of life. Who can understand how the two are related? But if life and death are companions, why should you be concerned? All things are connected at the root. We arrive here from the unknown and go back to where we came from. What people love about life is its miraculous beauty. What they hate about death is the loss and decay around it. Yet losing is not losing, and decay turns into beauty, as beauty turns back into decay. We are breathed in, breathed out. Therefore, all you need is to understand the one breath that makes up the world. The master is always conscious of the mystery at the heart of all things. Very beautiful. We're all masters. And I think it's important to maintain the sense of mystery. Sometimes the tendency is to make a story about it and somehow fix it. And I think it might help in the short run, but in the long run, the truth is we don't know. So thank you. We're just about to plunge into book three of this. I think we have the last one of book two, which is pretty short. And then I don't know why the book, it was set apart like that, but it must have something to do with Dogen's practice or how he put it all together. But we're on page 51, number 26.
He also said, is the way attained by means of the mind or by means of the body? In the scholastic schools, they say that body and mind are identical. And they say that the path is attained by way of the body. Yet they say it is because of this identity. Therefore, the fact that it is truly the attainment of the body is not made clear.
Now in our school, both body and mind attain together. Between them, as long as you use your mind to judge and compare the Buddhist teachings, you will never attain it in 10,000 eons in 1,000 lifetimes. When you let go of your mind and abandon knowledge and understanding, that is when you attain it.
Cases like, quote, seeing form illuminating the mind, hearing sound awakening to the web, are also the attainment of the body. Therefore, if you completely abandon the thoughts and views of the mind and simply sit, the path will be found near at hand. Thus, the attainment of the way is accomplished by means of the body. Therefore, it is my feeling and advice that you should concentrate on sitting alone.
There's lots of talk about that this these days. The more the mind is being studied by many different kinds of scientists, the more they're discovering how little conscious control we have over our minds, and that conscious control usually comes after. It's very curious, and it's exactly what Buddha saw so long ago, that there's every kind of mind in us, envious and angry and voluptuous and charming and deep and shallow and everything you can imagine. And the way that we operate on automatic is simply whatever comes in hits us in a certain way and calls up one of those seeds, Thich Nhat Hanh calls them. And we react. Karma means action. So we carry in our mind all the potential for acting in myriad different ways. And they found that we're tremendously affected by our surroundings. So if everybody has a dark view, it's very hard to sustain a lighter kind of mind. If everybody is prejudiced in a certain way, it's very, very much harder to sustain a lack of prejudice in that way. You just tend to go this way and this way and this way. And it's in our body. It's our nervous system. It's our brain. I've been invited to be the token Buddhist in Tenny Wright's class at the university over here on Thursday. Usually, it's about religion, and he introduces Zen to them and Suzuki Roshi along with a lot of different other things. He's a very imaginative teacher. He shows movies, prize fighting movies, and all kinds of funny things. But this time, he's offering a class on how to find the way. So I've been thinking of how in the world to go and talk about how to find a way. It isn't like that. It's more like the way finds us. And the more we allow ourselves to be found, the less traumatized our life can be. So it's a wonderful subject, and he's right onto it right here. If you let go of your mind and abandon your knowledge and understanding, that's when it all begins to work. We don't have to know what we're doing or justify what we're doing. I think we're trained for justifying. And justifying means putting the type in a line. That's all it is. That's you justify the type in the book, so it's all straight all the way down. So justifying our ideas means that we're cramming them into some kind of already decided notion. We're trying to make ourselves fit in some way that means that in this sense that some words get chopped off and have to have a little and then go in the next line. So it's not a very natural way to be. So I really appreciate this. It says, abandon the thoughts and views of the mind and simply sit. The path will be found near at hand. It's right here. No place else. It's just right here. So that's how he ends book two. Are there questions? Comments? Julian?
The justifying process. I mean, we're trying to make sense of our experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the way the mind, I mean, we naturally use words, for example, and like trying to put kind of shape it. That's not that wouldn't be justifying anything.
Well, it's making a story about our life. We do that. You know, it's completely natural. It's because we have words that we can think. I mean, we're creating a world and a life just by the fact that we can think. But we have to know that it's a story. And if we know it's a story, it doesn't mean that we throw it away, but that we know it's a story and are willing to take in whatever new thing comes along so that the story continues to change. So when we talk about justifying our life, it's like meeting criticism by saying the things that we think will make it seem like we fit. And meeting criticism can be a very painful thing in that way. But if we meet it not by justifying ourselves, but by listening carefully to what the criticism is, and then taking it in and appreciating it and then deciding whether it's true or not without trying to trying to fit into to what the other person is saying. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The best way is to be as flexible as possible. Doesn't mean being a doormat. It means being really upright and present. But being yourself, not trying to be somebody else.
Last night I was reading a translation on the Stanford Soba Zen Translation Project, and one of the recent chapters they made a translation of from Dogen Shogenzo is the one where he makes a commentary about the famous koan, about the person hanging over the precipice, biting onto a vine, and he's at this infinite drop below him. And he's asked the question by another student, so what does it mean? You know, what is it?
Yes.
It was the academic commentary points out how short this chapter is, but I couldn't understand a word of it. And one of the things that Dogen says is something to the effect of that the person biting and holding on to this vine so he doesn't fall is so complete. The biting action itself is so complete that his world is only that biting. There is nothing other than that left for him.
Mm-hmm.
And in the section here, he uses the word completely.
Mm-hmm.
He often, Suzuki uses the word no trace, which I believe
yes.
is not original with Suzuki Roshi. It goes back to.
Yeah.
And I keep on seeing this idea of, and it's not an idea, it's a state, it's a being of no trace, complete abandonment at the precipice, on the edge, unknowing. And I see something in common there. And of course, they're always talking about us and our lives at every moment. That is us. And it's hard, although I could say the words that it is us, to understand that we could walk outside the door tonight and be dead between the time we leave here and be home. In some sense, that's what it means. It can be just a finite
yes.
thing, just a physical thing. But I think there's something there about how we approach being. Like, we don't see ourselves biting on the vine at every moment as if it were total. Why is it that we don't see those moment after moment that it is so total? Because when we do see it as total, it does feel like that's the way.
It's based on Zazen. So Zazen experience itself is dropping off. Holding on also. Very tight. And if we're lucky, Colvin sometimes said, you know, he would pray, Zazen, come to me, come to me. It doesn't always come. But it itself is the dropping off. And the longer we sit, the more familiar that experience becomes, and the more intensified it can become. So it's not just everyday life where we're sort of leaving a trail behind us of the past as we go blindly into the future, but it's an experience actually on the cushion of, and in the next, I think it's the The next chapter or the one right after it where he talks about this very thing? No, it's the next one. It's about the 100-foot pole. So you really nailed it. Well,
didn't she? I didn't look ahead, really.
No, I'm sure you didn't.
No, no.
It's just one of the synergistic things that happens. But we could read this, because it's really the same subject. I think it's Ellie's turn, huh?
He instructed, those who study the path must let go of mind and body and enter wholly into the way of a Buddha. An ancient said, atop a 100-foot pole, how will we step forward? Thus, having climbed to the top of a 100-foot pole, there is a mind which thinks that it will die but lets go its foothold and so holds fast. The admonition to take a step forward means that having concluded that it would not be bad, then, so as to cast off body and mind, one must deliberately abandon everything, from his worldly occupations to his lifetime career. As long as he does not abandon these, no matter if he steps away with his own urgency as a digging out of fire on his head, it would still be impossible to attain the way. You must settle your resolve and cast off my mind.
There it is. There it is. There are different versions of that story of the cliff, where the fellow is clinging to the cliff and a tiger is down below and is going to eat him if he lets go, and there's a little strawberry growing right next to him, and he just reaches over and eats the strawberry as he says, it's delicious, absolutely delicious. That's how we live, if we live with joy. Yeah. Taste the strawberry, because we may not make it home tonight. And some night we definitely will not make it home. So, and we don't know when that is. What Arthur said when he received his rakusu, he said, don't wait for so long. Don't wait like I did. He died 2 days after he received it. Shall we go on? Is there more about this?
Chip understood. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I understand the concept of what, you know, really embracing each and every moment for what it is, but sometimes, I mean, without that dramatic thing about, you know, whatever, the guy hanging from the rope, isn't that kind of idealistic? I mean, there's also kind of the concept of letting go, no?
That is letting go.
That moment, that, mm-hmm.
Okay,
this is my life right here. Like,
this is it, and you step right off the pole.
Okay, what's just stepping off the pole?
path.
Letting go of how we hold on to our life.
Seems like there's an infinite letting go.
It is.
I mean, never, like, even when you think you let go, you haven't.
Exactly. That's why we sit zazen until we die. Well, and if we don't sit zazen, it makes dying really hard. No, usually. Much, much harder. And life much harder. You know, it's clinging. It's the holding on tight. Of course we hold on. But if we don't let go when we have to let go, when we should let go, or when it's well to let go and wholesome and happy to let go.
Aren't you kind of helpless in that way that, I mean, we never, I mean, we try our best, but we don't really know whether we should or we can. I mean, I guess the Prajnaparamita kind of, that, I don't know, you have kind of an instinct for what may bring most peace, maybe.
Well, we depend on our own deep wisdom. That's what prajna is. So, if we allow that to function fully and freely, then we don't have to worry so much about figuring out what to do and where to go. It's already happening.
It's like lying, like, it actually puts a lot more pressure on you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Telling
the truth, the painful truth, right?
Right.
Brent.
Much earlier, you said, when talking about the classroom and the student, it's not how to find the way, it's how to let the way find you. And being open to. Could you elaborate on that? What would you say is making yourself available for the way?
Well, it probably has many, many levels, from the most practical of, you know, looking in the want ads, or, you know, all the way to sitting with it. I find that there are many times when I don't have a clue what to do, and the only way that I know how to know, or not even to know, but just, I just keep sitting until I find, until I'm found by the way, it feels like. Until I find myself doing what needs to be done, and it all seems to be working in a way that I never would have figured out. Mm-hmm. But I also ponder, you know, if it's a big puzzle, I ponder a lot. And ask for advice and, you know, go to the library and whatever resources there are. I think we generate as much input as we can. But at the same time, we don't have total control over the situation. We have to let it all work itself out as it will. And sometimes it takes a while. And that's the most frustrating part. Even if you have real faith in the process, it still is frustrating if it isn't happening the way you think it ought to go. So it has something to do with trusting it, too. Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome. Good luck. Allie?
Start to see possibilities that are really just kind of random combinations of colors or anything, just and kind of treat my life as an experiment mm-hmm. to a certain extent. I think I need to come back to my zazen more to not get too distracted by all the combinations mm-hmm. I see out in the world. But I do find a lot of amazing things. It's just if I'm slowing down enough to see them. And to break out of my certainty that I know what's what.
Yes. Yes. Even a rock or a blade of grass can be a whole new piece of information if we just stop and really look. That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. And that is falling off the 100-foot pole also. It's giving yourself to where you are and what you see and taste and smell. Yeah. Don't get in your own way.
You know probably better than I do, but the Korean Zen teacher is the only don't know
yes.
teacher.
Yes.
I sometimes think that it's just I have to get rid of my
mm-hmm.
no, I know what this is.
Yes. Yes. Yes, Sansa Nim, only don't know. His whole school was only don't know. Thank you.
There's a difference between that kind of sensitivity, though, and it's a little people talked about this experiment where, okay, I'm going to, when you buy a car, when I bought my car, suddenly I was seeing
yes.
the different kinds of, but that's not like serendipity. I mean, it's just like my perception had been directed to a certain, and that's not what we're talking about in terms of serendipity.
Oh, that's a part of it too. That's
the perception is so tricky.
Yes.
That's why I like that. I don't know.
Yes.
Could be being led anywhere. I mean.
Yeah. We don't know. Yes.
You said earlier, I think you said that we don't know, but then something that's for after. I don't know if it was the knowing that's for after. Something was for after.
No, I don't remember.
But something like something about knowing or understanding.
Yeah. I know, because when we're in the middle of doing something, acting, deciding even, you can't really say you're doing it because you don't know about it until after it's over and you look back. Then you say, I did this and I did that. But actually, while you were doing it, you weren't doing it. It's just like speaking. Now, I don't think each word before I say it. It just comes. And our doing just comes also. And it's there are many different aspects to it. It's the world that we're in that defines what we can do and also what we can think. But all of that is really in retrospect. We look back and say, I decided to get married. I decided to move to California. Now, when I look back from all these years that I've lived, I'm just amazed at all those decisions that I didn't really make. It just happened. But of course, we have to put all of ourselves into our decisions at the same time. You know, there's that level also where we really need to use careful discrimination and not just plunge into any old thing. But so knowing is on many levels. There's the prajna knowing, and there's the vijna knowing, which is taking everything apart and naming all the pieces. And then there's a looking back after we've already, it's already done. It's a process.
There's been times in my life where I came somewhere where I don't really want to be.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it was something that brought me there.
And sometimes it's very helpful to examine, and we can't know everything that brought us there. All the causes and conditions go back to Adam and Eve and before. But sometimes there's some very personal, fairly present things that happen that will help us understand how our mind is working and bringing us into situations that maybe we don't want to be in. Part of our conditioning gets involved. Yes, yes. So self-knowledge is really important. Is it time? Well, yes, indeed, it is after time.